Hello, my oral surgery friends. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. In this podcast, you will hear surgeons discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. The goal of this podcast is to evaluate every aspect that a surgeon can improve in order to create a better experience for patients, staff, and the surgeon. Most of the information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions. The methods discussed are meant to provoke thought and should be supplemented with research into the approved studies prior to making changes to one's way of practice. Without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Welcome to another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. This is Dr. Grant Stuckey. Today I'm joined by Dr. Dan Tran. He is an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Richmond, Virginia. Is that correct, Dan?
That's correct.
Awesome, man. Thank you for joining me. So I was hoping you could give us a brief kind of history of your training and your current practice setup.
First off, thanks for having me, Grant. I've been in Virginia my whole life. I grew up here, was born here, and I guess I liked it so much I never wanted to leave. I went to dental school here at VCU, was introduced into oral and facial surgery during my D1 year. Didn't really know much about it, but then once I found out about it, fell in love with it and decided after D1 year, this is what I'm going to do. I spent a ton of time with the residents here, attendings at VCU, but it was like a delicate balance, as all of us know, right? Because you don't want to spend too much time with them or else they get sick of you and you're like that annoying guy who shows up all the time. Yeah. But you also don't want to show up too little time and then they're like, who is this guy? All of a sudden he wants to do OMFS, but he hasn't ever talked to any of us. So that was definitely one of the hardest part was when you have a home program is balancing the two and making sure that you didn't say one sentence that like, you know, rubbed one of the residents or the attendings the wrong way. Fortunately, I didn't say any of those things. I think I balanced it really well, matched into VCU for residency, and have been able to have some pretty great mentors here. Dr. Albacher's here. He's the chairman. Dr. Strauss is the program director. Dr. Deeb is the implant director. The one who kind of started it all was Dr. DeLuke, who was my the pre-doc oral and facial surgery director. The whole time when I first got into residency or even in dental school, I thought I was going straight to private practice. Never thought that I was ever going to try to do anything other than that. I was set. I had spoken with some other oral surgeons up in Northern Virginia and locally in Richmond, and they all were under the assumption that I was going to private practice. So I had things lined up. But then during the last 2 years of residency, I was approached by Dr. Albacher, Dr. Strauss, and Dr. Deeb, all three of them. And they all kind of hinted at saying, oh, have you ever thought about doing academics or thinking about staying and teaching? And I was like, no, I would never would have done that. Never thought I could. What can I teach? I would just graduate. You guys just taught me like bare minimum what I need to know to become a normal oral and facial surgeon. But I was like, what could I possibly bring to the table? Then I started talking to them more about it. The more they started talking about it, I was like, you know, maybe I could do something like this. I learned a little bit from all of them, and so it was like I was a mix of all of our mentors and teachers, you know? And so I eventually decided that it's easier for someone to go from academics to private practice than for somebody to go from private practice to academics. I think just because the scope becomes a little bit more narrow typically when you go to private practice, but when you're in academics, you have a pretty broad scope. And so I was like, you know what, let's try this out. Now, that was, July of last year when I first started. June is when I finished. And so I'm finishing up my first year as an attending at VCU. I have found out that it was one of the best decisions I ever made. I love every minute of it. I can't see myself doing anything else. It's enjoyable. It's fun. The camaraderie is great. Spending time with residents is great. Spending time with other attendings is great. My main focus right now, as far as resident teaching, is bone grafting, implants, 3D printing. What I do enjoy is pathology and reconstruction. As the new attending, I cover a lot of trauma. Then I do some orthognathic whenever the other attendings may be too busy or we just get influx with too many patients. And they're like, hey, can you go ahead and do this orthognathic case? And I'll go ahead and cover that case for them. But so far, everything's been great and I love it.
That's awesome. Wow, that's terrific. VCU is such an awesome program. It seems like they have like a huge scope of things that they do. They cover so much trauma and orthognathics and pathology.
It's definitely been a cool place to have been trained. And I think that we definitely have a very good broad scope. The only thing that we don't really do here is malignancy or any type of cancer surgery. And so all that's handled by the ENT surgeons here. And I think that's all been kind of by design. It would be difficult for us to do all these different things and be a premier cancer center as well. So, but it's definitely been fortunate here to be trained under these guys and still work with them now and have them as my mentors and colleagues.
That's awesome. And then, you know, I became familiar with you, I believe it was through an Amos article that you kind of talked about your story of being a patient and you have a diagnosis of cancer. Is that correct?
Yeah. So unfortunately, this was during my second year of residency. So this is back in 2017. I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer during my second year of residency. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. And I still have it, obviously, because you can't cure stage 4 cancer. And this all happened during my second year of residency. Still remember pretty vividly during anesthesia rotation. So, I mean, we all know what anesthesia rotation is like, right? It's pretty much like 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. Everyone clocks out. You're done. It's great. That's a time for you to go and finally see the sun again, to see your family again, if you have a family, or go out with friends. One of the best things was during anesthesia rotation here, we don't have to cover weekends. And so it's always like, oh, what are you going to be doing in May on this weekend? And before, you're always like, I have no idea. The call schedule's not out yet. But if you're on anesthesia, you're like, oh, let me check. Oh, yeah, I'm free every single weekend in May, kind of thing, you know? And so I was really looking forward to that. And I was like, this is like the best time for you to start getting in shape, like do so many things that you couldn't ever do before. But unfortunately, I started off my first month of anesthesia rotation, paired it with somebody with like this lingering back pain. And I was like, I just had a daughter too. She was 2 months old at the time. And I was like, you know, maybe it's because I'm picking her up, putting her down. That's what's causing my back pain. But, you know, thinking back, that doesn't make any sense because she only weighed like 10 pounds. So I don't know how I would have back pain from that. And we're sitting around chucking third molars and teeth all day. And that doesn't cause any back pain. But I was pushing around the stretcher from pre-op to the OR, going back and forth with the stretcher. And I just started noticing like my back was hurting occasionally. Like when I tried to go and innovate a patient, I would feel this electric shock just shoot through my legs. And I was like, what the heck is that? Started having paresthesia and hyposthesia on my lower extremities. I couldn't sleep at night. I had to sleep on the sofa, like sitting straight up. I couldn't lay back on a bed anymore. And I kept doing this hoping that it was just going to go away. And as you know, like as a resident, you really don't have time to go see doctors either, which is ironic because you're surrounded by doctors. And so finally, the attending I was with told me, hey, you need to go get this checked and you need to go get this figured out. I went to go get a plain film x-ray, which was negative. So I was like, okay, I have no idea what's going on. Nothing showed up. So maybe I'm okay. Kept going on with work. And then finally, the pain just became way too much. The pain, the shocks going through my leg, everything. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is just unbearable. I had been dealing with it for about 3 weeks and I was like, this is it, enough's enough. And I decided that it's time for me to go ahead and go to the emergency department. So it was like Saturday, I went to the emergency department and I just went in there and I just said, I want an MRI. Something's wrong. Not sure what it is, but I needed an MRI because something's going on with the nerves in my back. Because that's the only thing I could think of. It was like a herniated disc or something. And they're like, okay, all right, we can do that. And so they got the MRI. And then, so I went to the imaging area. And that's kind of like when I knew things were bad because they got the imaging done. And then they said, hey, we have to go and do some more images. And I was like, whoa, you kind of have that idea that something's going on because you can get the feeling from the text, you know, when they're trying to ask you to get more imaging. And you're like, oh, no, everything's fine. I'm like, oh, no, it's not, because I've done that before. I've ordered extra imaging. So I know it's not okay. So I was like, all right. They got me out of the CT scanner and the MRI. And they wheeled me out in the wheelchair. And then this is when I knew it was really bad, is the radiologist wants to speak with you. And then I was like, whoa. First off, radiologists don't speak to patients, right? Like, that's why they're radiologists. You know what I mean? Like, they don't want to talk to anybody. And I was like, oh, no. And then they wheeled me back and showed me the CT scan, showed me the MRIs. And he knew I was a resident. And I think that's kind of why he was okay talking to me directly. And he said, hey, this is what's going on. We took imaging of your spine. You got 3 different lesions throughout your spine. Not sure what it is, but I'm just going to be honest with you and high likelihood it's some type of cancer. And I was like, are you sure there's nothing else could possibly be? He's like, no. I mean, you could possibly have three different hematomas throughout your spine, but that's super rare. He's like, we got to go get some more imaging to figure out where the primary tumor is. So went in and found out, got some more imaging and found out that I had a lesion in my lung, my right upper lobe, that they think had caused and spread to my spine. When I got that diagnosis, I was like, oh my God, what the heck? You know, you spend so much work, effort to try to get into, and it's weird. The first thing that came up was in my mind was residency. I think we just are just grown differently with our mindset and our like drive. And so the first thing that came to me was, how am I going to finish residency? Do I have enough sick days? Do I need to make up this year? And thinking back, that was kind of dumb to think about. Like, you're thinking about residency, like you just got diagnosed with cancer. And the first thing you're thinking about is, how am I going to finish? And I think it was just like, you spend your whole life trying to get here, you know? And you finally get there and then you're like, it's about to all get taken away from me. And so I quickly forgot about that. And about 10 minutes passed, and I was like, well, actually, you know, now I have a 2-month-old daughter. I have a wife. I have a family. Like, that's so much more to worry about now. Like, it's not just me anymore. It's my family. Oh, and I forgot to mention that the CT scan showed the reason why I was having the back pain, I had a pathologic fracture at T10. And so I've been working with the pathologic fracture in my spine that caused the numbness and the severe back pain. So that's why I was hurting for so long. And I just kind of just tried to shake it off thinking that, oh yeah, it's probably nothing, right? So they had to go and they took me to the operating room that Monday to fuse my spine and to go ahead and take the tumor out of my spine, because it had been pretty tightly adhered to my spinal cord. And so they had to peel it off the spinal cord and fuse T10 or T10 to T12, I believe, is where they had fused my spine. And so I was in a brace and everything, and obviously had to be out of commission for a while I was trying to heal. But yeah, it was quite an adventure, man.
Jeez. And then what was so they did a biopsy, found it out, fused the spine.
Yeah, they did a biopsy. The assumption was that it was lung cancer because of the CT scan. That was all they were going off of. They didn't go for the lung lesion at all. And so they sent it in for, I was lucky enough to have an oncologist that knew about next generation sequencing, where that's where they do the molecular profile on tumors to figure out if they have any drivers or mutations that drive the tumor. And there's quite a few of them that are for lung cancer, especially for someone who's as young as me. It's kind of weird for somebody like me to have lung cancer. I was diagnosed when I was like 30 at the time when I was diagnosed. And so they sent in the tumor to get it read, and I was negative for the first three, but there was one special marker that was positive, the last marker actually that possibly could have been positive, and it was something called an ALK translocation. And so once they found out that I had that, I didn't have to go through chemo or anything. I got radiation to my spine to kill the residual tumors, and I started on this tyrosine kinase inhibitor called alectinib. And it kind of, I think there's some of it in head and neck surgery right now, in which we use it for, especially for EGFR and other types of mutations. And it's used in melanoma sometimes now as well as I think a myeloblastoma expresses a certain type of driver as well, which they're doing some research on. But the tumor that I had a driver as well, and I was able to take these pills. So I take these pills twice a day, and it kind of puts the cancer to sleep. So it doesn't quite kill it all the way per se. And it's like a maintenance therapy. So I've been taking it for the past 3 years now. I get CT scans every 3 months. And on the first CT scan I got, it was just amazing how much the tumor shrank, almost non-existent. It turned into almost a cystic cavity after I had been on the medication for 3 months. And so it's definitely a miracle drug that I have. It's been good enough that I was able to resume residency, finish residency, and it doesn't really impact my daily life very much. I get a little bit more fatigue here and there, but other than that, it's not too bad. They say that this medication works for about 3 years to 4 years. 50% of people, it works for about 3 to 4 years. Unfortunately, I'm on year 3 of 3 right now, and so I don't know how long this medication is going to work. I hope it works indefinitely, but the cancer with this medication always wins. So eventually the cancer finds a way and mutates around it. I've heard of people being on for 5 years, 6 years even. And there's some other newer drugs coming out, and I'm crossing my fingers that they're going to work. But it's definitely still not a cure yet, and it's still not over yet, as much as I'd like to think it would be over. So still live 3 months at a time. I get my CT scans every 3 months, and I try to not think about it, but the day of is the only time where I really actually stress out about it. Say, hey, oh, I forgot I have cancer still. It's actually the first time I ever forgot that I had cancer was probably 3 or 4 months ago. I was like, oh man, I forgot. I have to go get my CT scan soon, don't I? And I was like, oh, I never thought that day would ever come where I would just forget that I have cancer. So I've definitely been fortunate to go from thinking I only had 3 to 6 months to live to now being 3.5 years out. So it's been good.
Wow. And going through all of that, I mean, how did that change your perspective? Or, I mean, what did you learn from that? Did it change you in any way as a surgeon and the way you interact with your patients?
So the first thing I have to say is that being a doctor makes you a pretty bad patient. Doctors are the worst patients. You know, just enough to be annoying to other doctors, but not enough to be helpful at all. I was definitely one of those doctors. Quickly, I learned to, if I keep doing stuff like that, that they're really going to dislike me. And so I kind of let them do their job now. And I've had a great team of doctors. I think the first time I met my oncologist, I had gone on to UpToDate and read other articles on how do I treat this type of cancer. And he like knew all the answers. He knew all the articles and the journals and the years of the journals, I was like, and the studies, and I was like, oh man, okay, this guy knows this stuff. So I was like, okay, I trust this guy now. With patients, it's kind of allowed me to slow down and spend more time with patients and empathize with patients. I just finished residency last year, so I've only been practicing as an attending for a year. So majority of my experience right now is from what I experienced during residency. And from what I remember during residency is that there's so much to do. There's so many tasks that you have to complete. You just don't feel like you ever have enough time. And you sometimes forget that these patients aren't just a task, but it's another human being on the other side who came to you for help because they have a problem. They need something that you can help them with. And sometimes I know that I've been guilty of doing things like this where you kind of brush off a patient and you're like, oh no, it's nothing, don't worry about it, it's nothing, that we don't find anything. But it's really the empathy and all the patient really wants is for you to just sit there, talk to them, and kind of walk them through it, even if it is nothing, just to be like, I understand where you're coming from, I know you're frustrated, but this is what I see, this is what other people have seen, and looking at your scans, looking at your mouth, this is what's going on, and this is what I think could be going on. And just sitting down and making sure that they completely understand as well, instead of just running from room to room for room, just seeing patients and trying to get through the consults as quick as you can. That's definitely changed the way that I have practiced. Spent a lot more time just talking with the patient, empathizing with them, and maybe sometimes not even talking as much about the diagnosis of disease. They sometimes just want somebody to talk to. And then, so that's definitely helped.
That reminds me of a quote I heard once where it says, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And
oh, yeah. Oh, man, that's a great quote. Yes.
I feel like it's often the case. Yeah, especially with patients. I mean, even with your family members or other people, but with patients especially, I think oftentimes I first approach the interaction of, tell me about your life, about the pain, what's going on. You do the talking, I will listen because I do care, that as opposed to I'm telling you what's happening and we're doing this as quick as possible. And I find that when I ask about their personal life, especially, people all of a sudden, they kind of start listening and respecting you more. And okay, this guy cares a little bit more about me than just another mouth,
Yeah, completely agree. You definitely build that trust with the patient, and you're right. They really don't care about what you know unless they know that you care. I mean, you could be the smartest, most talented surgeon in the room, and the patient wouldn't even care. They just want to know that if something happens, that you're going to give it your all and give it your best.
Yep, for sure. Man, and what a hard time, crazy time for that diagnosis, to happen to you, and all the aftermath is like probably in the busiest time of your life, and in residency, I think. It's such a crazy time.
It is, and it is. I mean, residency is like those 4 years are just, I would not wish that upon anybody. It is a tough 4 years. I think that if I was lucky to be at VCU, I think the faculty, the residents, I mean, they were so understanding. They worked with me. They all came to visit me in the hospital. They all came to visit me at my house on days where it was during winter when I had come back home from the hospital around Christmas time. In January or February, I still was recovering from my back surgery, so I couldn't really lift anything. And snow had poured down, but I needed to get to my radiation treatments. And so I was like, I'm kind of stuck in my house and I need to get to the hospital. So three or four of the residents just drove over to my house and just shoveled in my driveway, sprinkled salt on, and I was able to get to my treatment. And it was great. And I don't know if I feel like VCU, the great part about the people here is it's like a family. And so I really felt like they all cared for me as well. They didn't think of me as like another worker bee, somebody to just go and get stuff done, somebody to just go and take call or just get this procedure done or get this patient admitted. They truly saw me as family. And I think that experience kind of, not just that experience, but my all 4 years here really showed me that everyone here truly cares about you. And when they asked me to stay on as faculty, I knew they meant it and that they really wanted to see me succeed and really wanted to mentor me in practice and in academics. So definitely fortunate to have the people that I went to training with at that time.
Wow, that's awesome. So great to hear that they kind of rallied around you and helped you and treated you like a brother.
Yeah.
That's tremendous. And I'm sure it changed your outlook to some degree, you know, on life and the rest of your life. It's crazy to be living, like you said, every 3 months, you know, to the next scan, to the next, you know, medication. How do you deal with all of that?
It is psychologically difficult. The hardest parts is in normal everyday conversation when people start talking about too far into the future. That's when it really hits me. When people start talking about, oh yeah, let's just, sometimes it's like either just vacation or house or what school your kids are going to go to. And that's when it really hits me tough, because it's like, you guys can freely talk about 2 to 3 years from now, even 5 years from now. But for me, I can't. That I haven't quite found a great coping mechanism for yet. But I do try to think about the fact that we all have a date. None of us actually know when, you know, we may pass. And so I could just as easily get hit by a car walking to the parking lot. And so that kind of helps a little bit, thinking that, okay, well, none of us truly know. And I don't know where the medications are going to go. I don't know where the treatments are going to go. I hope that there could be a cure sometime in the future, but I have no idea if that's going to happen. It definitely does get tough when people start talking too far into the future. Because like I said, I really can only be thinking about 3 months at a time. Recently, I started thinking about years instead of like a couple years or a year or two. I think the most important thing for me is to make sure I enjoy every day as much as I can. Enjoy my daughter, enjoy my family. I try not to spend too much time at work because work isn't everything. I try to balance work and life a lot more now. I try to make sure that's a priority for me. Work is great. I enjoy what I do, but I also enjoy spending time with my wife and my daughter. And so any chance I get, I try to make sure that I can see her at least every day. Now that residency is over, it's a lot easier. And just make sure that the weekends I spend with her and just make the most out of it.
How old is she now?
She's 3 and a half, almost 4. Actually, she turns 4 in August. So she's almost 4 now.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's a fun age.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really fun age.
I have a 3-year-old as well. So fun, so cute.
Ah, it's great, man. And so I just love coming home and then having her run up to you and just say, Daddy, you're home. It's great, and just give you a big hug. Oh my god, it's one of the best feelings.
Oh, absolutely, man. You know, I can relate to some degree. Of course, I didn't have a diagnosis of cancer, but when I was about 35, I'm 40 now. When I was about 35, I started doing triathlons, and I started having some pretty severe lower back pain. I got an MRI, and my 4-5-5-1 discs in my lower back were just shot, like torn and and just a couple millimeters, just flat, almost bone on bone. And I, you know, had chronic pain since then. I had two disc replacements, actually in Germany, and that helped a lot. But I still, you know, there's days where my back flares up and it's just killing me, like to the point where, you know, I'm laying on the ground just crying after work.
Oh, yeah.
My back will last hopefully a long time, but for some reason, chronic pain, you know, and having a severe health problem like that, where your kind of life changes and you realize that you're never going to be like you once were, it definitely makes you think a lot more about death, about when is my time up. You know, your body all of a sudden goes from Superman, you know, you never think about it, and to, you know, my body is an expiring machine here. You know, I only have a certain finite amount of time left in this life. And I think like you're talking about, a lot of things happen to you once you get that perspective, especially the whole, you know, let's enjoy the time with the most meaningful people in my life. But another thing too that happened to me is I just felt the strong desire to create, you know, to create things that will last after I'm gone. You know, I think the podcast is one of those things. My back pain really spurred me to do something like this, because I felt like I looked at my life and I'm like, you know, what really am I doing to help the world, to help, you know, my kids and other things? And I kind of had to take a look at my life and say, what are some things that I could do to help the people around me and kind of, you know, go on after I'm gone? But I don't know if you've felt that or had that desire to kind of create or...
No, I definitely can see where you're coming from and relate a little bit to you. I did maybe had an early midlife crisis. I guess I got an acceleration into my midlife crisis when I got diagnosed. And you do start thinking, am I just going to be the guy who takes out teeth and puts in implants and collects a paycheck for 30 years straight? Which is nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's a great way to make a living and great way to provide for your family. And it's actually pretty fun to do too. But I started thinking about it and started seeing it and thinking, after my career, I kind of, like you said, want to leave some kind of legacy and kind of leave your mark, you know, here, even after you're gone. And for me, I thought teaching would be a great way to do that. You have these residents who, George D., one of the mentors here, he kind of put it really well. It's like training an Olympic team, you know, because you have some of the best and brightest of dental schools across the nation. And the top specialty in dentistry, I think at least, it's one of the most competitive and one of the most grueling specialties in dentistry. And you get to train these people to become surgeons. And it really is like trying to hone their skills and train them to be the best surgeons that they could ever be. And it really is like training like a team. You got the best athletes possible that you could ever ask for, which makes your job a little bit easier when you're trying to teach them. And knowing that each one that graduates under you is somebody who's going to go out to the world and help other patients. And it's almost like a multiplying factor for what you can do for people. As you know, as a provider, I can help treat only a certain number of patients a day, a certain number of patients a year. But as a teacher, I can multiply that by making new doctors who can also do the same thing that I do. And so that's kind of been a way that I thought of how I could potentially kind of leave my mark on this world and kind of my legacy.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't think of many better ways than teaching. It's so awesome. Such an amazing way to share what you've learned with other people. Very, very cool.
And it's nice because it's also fun. I mean,
yeah. And tons of variety.
It is. In terms of variety, in terms of, I think I'm at that stage still where I'm the young new attending. So I still kind of feel like it's just like my second chief year. And so it's like I get to hang out with the same group of people I was hanging out with, you know, last year. That's going to fade soon because, you know, that all the classes eventually have to leave and have to all eventually graduate. But I'm going to try to enjoy as much as I can for these next couple years before I actually feel like I'm a real attending. And I have residents that I wasn't co-residents with.
Side note, I did a 2-week externship at VCU. So I did my dental school training at UCLA. And I knew I wanted to do a four-year program. So I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was a year ahead of me, and he said, oh, VCU is amazing. So I went, and I was just blown away by the amount of training and like experience and research that all the attendings there had. Because I think it's a similar group, but back then, which was, oh gosh.
I think it is. I don't think they changed, and that's why.
Yeah.
It's a pretty stable group. I mean, yeah, Albacher has been chair for like 30 plus years, I think. Strauss has been program director for, I think, the same amount of time. So both of them have been here. Laskin is still here.
Oh my gosh.
Laskin's like right down the hall for me. Then you got Deeb, who joined like 10 years ago, and he's now our bone graft implant guy. And we have Renan Picard now. He's one of the newer attendings. Siobhan Renan Picard, he's been here for about 5-6 years. He's our TMJ total joint guy. Another great thing that's happened here was VCU has not been able to convert a single person to become an academician in like 25 or 30 years. I think it's because here we create really great clinical surgeons. So you leave here and you can go to private practice and just hit the ground running. And so everyone wants to go straight to private practice. Nobody wants to stay around because they're like, oh, I mean, I can just go do this really quick. I'm really good at this. And so we haven't been able to keep anybody. I think they've been trying to convert anybody to like convince them to go in academics. But this past year, of the three graduates, it was me. So I stayed here. And then my co-resident, who is Daniel Hawkins, he stayed on his faculty as well. So now we have two new faculties, which is even more fun than I could have expected. Like, oh, I get to hang out with my co-resident still. It's awesome. And then my other co-resident, Raj King, he's in Toronto right now with Cam and Nitty doing a TMJ fellowship. And so he's doing a fellowship, and it's like no one here ever leaves to go do fellowship or academics. And we got three guys who, if you had seen us when we were interns, you would be like, these guys aren't going to be doing anything related to that. So things can change pretty quickly in 4 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Definitely a fun job to have.
Very, very cool. Dr. Strauss was kind of one of those interesting characters to me. You know, he's kind of like, I don't want to say the mean version of Rick Moranis, but he was just kind of more, you know, in your face and questioning you and all this stuff. And
oh, he still is.
As a dental student, it's slightly intimidating.
Oh, yeah, I know.
After a few days, you're just like, okay, this guy, he's just kind of say whatever he's thinking.
I think that he does this thing to like just scare the Jesus out of you once you're an intern. And we have the hospital clinic, and you just graduated dental school. You don't know what you're doing, you know? Like, so you're like, no, I really don't want to do anything wrong. And so you ask him a question, and this is when like your first month of intern year, and I've seen it happen every year. I don't know if he knows that he does this, but first month of every intern year, and I would witness it happen. One of some interns would not realize what they're about to get into to try to present some patient to him. And it could be something as benign as this patient has like hypertension and diabetes or something. And they would just get crushed in front of everybody. And then from that day on, all the interns would be like, oh my God, I got to read about everything before I go even dare talk to him. And so from then on, I would spend like 30 minutes, like after like interviewing and meeting the patient for like talking to them for like 15 minutes, I would spend the next 15, 20 minutes reading about every single disease or disorder right before I went to go talk to him to present the case. And I think that's probably his method of like getting you to like self-learn and like make sure you know your stuff before you go and talk to him. It was just weird because I remember the first year it happened. I was like, man, this is rough. I just like saw it happen to my co-resident. I was like, oh my God, I just sat in my chair. I was like, I'm not doing that. And then the next year I saw it happen to the next intern. I was like, what is happening again? This is like deja vu. I'm getting a little bit of PTSD from this. But he means well, and he's Dr. Strauss is a great surgeon. And every time I'm about to do something, his like voice is in the back of my mind saying, don't do that now. Or like be like, hey, make sure you check for this. And so it's almost like he's hovering behind me at all times.
That's hilarious, man. Yeah.
But I'm sure we all have mentors like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. The way we did it was at our case conference, they made the interns of the first years every single Monday, we had to present a case. Like, even if it was just a full mouth extraction. We were taken to the OR or something. But the first year had to present in front of everyone, do a PowerPoint.
Ooh, oh, man.
Yeah, every single week that you're on oral surgery. And they, the attendings and the chiefs would just have a field day, man, just ripping you apart. You know, how are you going to hold the blade? How are you going to use the periostal? Like anything they could pick at you. There's no way you could know everything. So they would find...
No, there's no way.
Yeah, they would find the chink in your armor and just start going at it.
And once they find that little weakness, oh, it's just over. Oh, man. Sometimes it's just easier just to take it. Just know you lost before you had started.
Exactly. I learned real quick that it's better just to say, I don't know. I will study that as opposed to trying to make something up and like try to.
It's always the best answer to say, I don't know, but I'll go look it up later. I get back to you with the answer. Found out that that trick worked really well early on. It helps the pain stop.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. You got to have some thick skin to make it through your first year. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. But once you get it through your first year, you really build that armor up. And it's definitely an accomplishment to get through your first year in its, of itself.
Oh, for sure, man. I hear the beeping in the background. Is there still construction going on there at VCU? Because when I was there, it was like a massive construction zone. That's like 15 years ago.
So they're actually building up a whole new ambulatory center across from you right now. It's like a skyscraper, or I don't know, it's 15 floors, I think. Not a skyscraper, but like 15 floors outpatient pavilion that they're building. But yeah, they're like always building here. I'm not sure when they're going to stop. I don't know if they're ever going to stop. And I think they're trying to build even more. I just don't know where yet. But eventually, I'm sure this area is just going to be a bunch of tall VCU buildings.
Wow. That's amazing.
Well, it's definitely changed a lot.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. Your story is just incredible. It's so inspiring, and the things that you've been able to make it through are amazing. And I'm sure you've got, you know, a lot of good and hard times ahead of you, but thank you for sharing a piece of your story with us.
Course.
If you're okay with it, we would end with our rapid fire questions. There's four questions I try to ask all of the interviewees.
Uh-huh.
The first one is, what is the best book you've read in the past year?
The best book I read the past year, it's a little bit of an unconventional book, not related to academics or fiction or anything like that. It's a book called The White Coat Investor by Jim Daly. It's an emergency physician to talk about like personal finance and like getting your financial house in order. Because as doctors and physicians and dentists and surgeons, like we don't get any training on that. We might get training on how to fix a pan-phase fracture, but no, we don't know how to set up our bank accounts and investment accounts and make sure that we don't have to do pan-phases for the rest of our lives. And so I thought that book is definitely been one of the most useful and informative books I've read over the past year.
Awesome. The next question is, what is a non-oral surgery thing that you've done or that you do that helps you with your oral surgery skills?
I think definitely it's got to be working with computers and 3D printing. I've always worked with computers since I was a kid, built computers when I was young. It doesn't really help with your hand skills per se, but definitely helps with pre-op like planning and applications within our field. Used to also play a lot of video games back in the day before I started residency. And so I think that helped a little bit with my hand skills as well. But now I don't really have time to do that. I just, you know, do surgery now and spend time with my daughter and family.
Awesome. What forceps do you use to extract tooth number 5?
I use an upper universal forceps, so the 150, but what do other people use? I'm open to changing my technique though if it's going to help me go a little faster. Like what are other people using it? I didn't know there was another option.
The other option is the Ash forceps.
Okay, the Ash. Okay. I was thinking of whether the Ash would be the other option, but that's such a weird angle. It's gonna be coming out like the cheek or something, like the commissure. But I was like, man, do people, so what's the spread on that? Is it like 80 upper universal, 20 Ash, or is it 50-50, or what's the...
I mean, I just get a kick out of this question. I just put it in there to make myself laugh, but it seems like it's about 50-50, maybe 60-40. There's a lot of people, most, I would say, edges toward the upper universal, But there's a lot of people who use the ash. I think the people who don't use the ash think that that's insane to use it because it's so there's so much leverage and you could just snap the crown off and things like that. But there are upper universals that are serrated, right? They have like more of a grip because I think that's an issue. People feel like with an ash, you can really grip the tooth and
grip onto that tooth.
You can go mesial distal instead of
gotcha. I think for canines, I think I use the ash occasionally when I'm not a big guy, so it's like it makes it a little bit easier for me to take out a canine. But I haven't used that on the number five before. But I might try it.
I would say it's probably better to use it on 4 or 13, but I still try to use it at first to do mesial distal, at least to loosen it, in a twisting fashion. Anyways, it's so stupid, man.
That's a good question, though. I like that question.
The last question is, what is your favorite quote?
My favorite quote is, if I've seen further than others, it is by standing upon the shoulders of giants. And I like this quote because it explains how everything that I did or anyone really does, the accomplishments that we all do are never truly your own, like solo. Everything that I've done or anything that anybody's ever done is because of the support of your family, mentors, and the support system that you have. I would never have gone through residency. I would have never gone through dental school if it wasn't for my wife, my parents, my family, and them helping me through it. And then now, I mean, nobody can really become a surgeon unless you had mentors, right? You need a faculty member or somebody to kind of get you there. And so I like to think that to make sure that everyone understands that no matter how successful you are, no matter what great things you do, it's never because of just you. It was because of who you surrounded yourself with to help you get you there.
Oh, I love it. Great quote. So true that there's such a huge group of people behind all of our successes and the things we do. And how important for us then to, boost up other people and lift them up so they can see even further than we're seeing. That's for sure what you're doing, teaching and residency, man. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. Are you okay if any of our listeners contact you to talk to you about residency or that, I don't know if anyone out there is listening has their own cancer diagnosis, but is that okay with you?
Of course. My email is trandq, trandq @vcu.edu. Email me anytime about anything. I mean, it doesn't even have to be OMFS related. It could be life related. It could be cancer related. It could be whatever's on your mind. If you feel like I could help talk you through something, for sure, email me and then we'll connect.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being willing to do that. All right. Well, have a good day. Good luck grinding it through in oral surgery.
Thanks, Corinne, and thanks for having me again, man.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Dan. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. If you are an oral and maxillofacial surgeon and would like to be on this podcast, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com or text me at 720-441-6059. Also, if you have any topics that you would like to hear discussed or feedback on a certain episode that has already aired, please call or email or text me. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.